So I'm one of those lawyers who started off at a big firm where we had all business clients, and I had no responsibility for dealing with clients, even as a mid-level associate, maybe dealing with the clients about the cases, but not about payment, about what they had to pay, never sent a client a bill. You just got to do the work and get paid pretty well and not have to be concerned about that. And then when I went out on my own, I at first was uncomfortable talking with people about money. It's difficult for a lot of us to talk to people about money. But if you're going out as a lawyer on your own, you need to get over that pretty quickly. And I certainly did. And now, you know, that needs to be a conversation that happens very early in when a client contacts you. They understand that this is how you make a living. They understand that they're going to have to pay for it, and there's no reason to shy away from talking about it. So I'm not the original presenter on this subject. It was a person called Ron Whitmer, and he had a nice acronym that he used in here to deal with this subject of, you know, the client has particular expectations about getting great work from us. We have an expectation of getting paid. And the acronym he used was CASH for each of these topics, okay? So, or each of the parts of his presentation. So the first part of the acronym, C, communication, having excellent communication with clients. It used to be that you had to, the only fee agreement required, maybe not the only one, but a fee agreement required, specifically required to be in writing was a contingent fee agreement. Now all of our fee arrangements are supposed to be in writing. And so that actually makes it easier for you to dealing with clients and to communicate with them about fees, because you can say, I'm required. The rules require me to do this. And to have a fee agreement that sets out the expectations clearly from the beginning. So, you know, it can be simply what you're going to charge, and if you're charging by the hour, what your hourly rate is. But it can say a lot more than that, and it could be an opportunity to really set the expectations for the representation with the client. I have started to include, I used to just have a simple fee letter, a 3 or 4 paragraph agreement. Or letter that would state, this is my hourly rate, I'm going to represent you in connection with this matter. You'll pay a retainer of X thousand dollars. I'll draw on the retainer, explain how the IALTA account works, and have a signature line for them, and they would sign on there, and I'd have my agreement. I've more recently decided to start putting a little bit more in there about expectations. I think it's a great opportunity, again, to just set forth the expectations of both parties. I include my responsibilities as well as theirs. So I tell clients that, and by the way, I did not bring any materials. Feel free to email me, and I'd be happy to send you a sample agreement or two. You can find me online. I've got a website. But I write in there, my responsibility will be to advise you of your rights and responsibilities, to reasonably consult with you about your objectives, about the means by which your objectives will be accomplished. Keep you reasonably informed about the case. Respond promptly to your requests for information. Be candid with you about issues that arise, possible outcomes, estimated amount of my time particular tasks are likely to take. And then represent your interest in court, negotiate a settlement when possible and if advisable, discuss with you courses of action, alternatives, and consequences. Now, I should have said my practice is mainly a litigation-based practice. I do business litigation, divorce and family law. And so this is these are the terms that I include in there. There you would have, obviously, different things if you were doing business transactions or estate planning or something like that. For the client, I've got in another place the client's responsibility to pay the bills promptly and to pay a retainer. But also, I've included in here now, this is based on experience with some particular clients, that it's the client's responsibility to discuss with me all relevant facts and not withhold important information about their case. Promptly provide me with documents and information when I ask for it. tell me about any important changes or developments in the case, and to be completely truthful in testifying and in their financial disclosures. You do need to state, if you get asking for a retainer, and we'll get to that on this, the second part, you do need to state the terms, and you need to make that clear in your written agreements with the clients. So that's C. Next one is A in this acronym we have, and that's advance. It is a very good practice, and perhaps in almost every case you handle, to get the client to pay money in advance. It's money against which you can draw, money you put in your IALTA account. Do you ask everybody for that? Well, maybe there are clients you're particularly secure with or who you've represented before and were always good about paying the bills. But generally, ask for a retainer, ask for an advance at the beginning. I have found, again, I've learned a lot of things in being in solo practice for the last 15 years, have found out the hard way that it is much easier to get money out of people when they need you than it is to get money out of people when they no longer need you. When the case is over, you're just one of possibly many creditors, you've got no particular leverage, and good luck getting paid. And I will get to that a little bit later because there are some things you can do. But much better, they know they have to pay you, they know that you're charging for your time or your services, and get the money up front. Now, in the divorce practice in particular, it can be difficult sometimes. That's an expensive proposition. How are you going to come up with the money? I actually have started using a service called LawPay, and it will enable you to receive payment by credit card into your IALTA account, and the merchant fees get charged against your operating account. So it's not like when you get paid ordinarily by credit card where you get less than the amount. You get the full amount, and then you pay for it separately out of your as an operating expense. I have found that to be, even though I end up getting a little bit less than my hourly rate, much better to get a much better collection rate using that or offering that. And in my fee agreement, I actually put the website URL in there and explain to people how they can pay this way. And in my bills, I do the same thing. So there are, again, talking to clients about money up front can be difficult, can make you feel squeamish. And when you put out a big number like $5,000 or $10,000 and you can see their reaction and you feel guilty and are you really worth this? And, well, can't you do a little work now and then get the money later or give them more time? You will learn the hard way if you do that, if you don't get the money up front. So the amount of the retainer varies depending on the kind of work you're going to do. If I'm going to be filing an appearance in litigation, it needs to be substantial. You're stuck. It's hard to get out. You're committed to doing you're committed to doing the work for this client. If it is another thing I do is consultation with people in employment disputes. For that, I can usually estimate this is going to be 2 or 3 hours, and I'll get a retainer worth 2 or 3 hours. I think one other advantage of a retainer is that it has the client thinking at the very beginning about how much this is going to cost, rather than having some sort of shock when they see your bill and see how those hours quickly add up. So it will scare some clients away. It may also, there are some clients out there who aren't always honest with you or might be manipulative. Early in my solo practice, I had a business client that who'd fired his previous lawyer, often a warning sign. When I called the lawyer for the files, he said, make sure you get a retainer, perhaps another warning sign. I asked the client for a retainer, and he seemed like a very nice guy, and he had so what sounded like some very legitimate complaints against his previous lawyer. He asked me, "Don't you trust me? How can we have this working relationship if you don't trust me?" And I learned that I should not have trusted him. He ended up with at least one more lawyer after me. So don't be manipulated. You're worth it. You're providing a valuable service, and people know they have to pay for it. So this is good to do at the very beginning of your representation.
David?
Yes?
Let me ask you a question on that point.
Yes.
A lot of clients will say, do you believe in my case?
Mm.
I need somebody who's going to believe me. And I'm curious at how folks react and respond to that.
Good question.
I heard it this morning.
Really?
Yeah.
I know, because you want to build in all those disclaimers, and there are. And one thing I didn't mention about my fee agreements, I do include in there a statement that I haven't made any kind of guarantee of the outcome. But I think you do have a responsibility at the beginning to be upfront and honest with the client about the case. I actually have just started reading a book about alternatives to the billable hour and trying to figure out some ways to charge people other than just foot by the hour.
Monthly.
I'm starting to think, monthly, right. In that book, it actually had, in the introduction, it said something like, you maybe the lawyer gives the client, we've got about a 60% chance of prevailing. And the client goes back and tells his spouse, the lawyer said, we'll probably win this. Right? Or that you're advising a client on a settlement and it's a $1 million case and you're giving them you're saying it, even if you, I would never give a percentage out likelihood of outcome, but say you're doing that and you're giving odds of 9-1 or something, you're telling the client, well, then you ought to be willing to settle for something like $900,000, right? You should discount it based on the likelihood that you may lose. But I think it's difficult to, you really have to emphasize with clients the lack of any guarantee of the outcome.
It's not just that. I think over time, experience tends to bring some light to this, but when the client starts talking to you in terms of, you have to believe me, you have to trust me, you have to be an advocate for my case, all they want to hear is rosy and we're going to win.
Yeah.
I think that's a real red flag, and I think it's really problematic. I had this conversation yesterday with a client because I tend to tell folks the range of what might happen. Here's what we need to work on. I don't know enough about your case yet. This is really at the beginning.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about your case yet to make a decision. But these are the issues that come up, and the client's response was, you don't believe me, do you? And the answer is, it's not my job to believe you or not believe you. Right now, we're too soon in the game. And if they keep pushing on that, I think that's somebody to walk away from. That's my personal opinion.
I think you're right, and you're bringing to my
conversation. Every conversation.
Yeah. And I think the thing is that a client who's taking that approach is going to, there's a risk of them hearing what they want to hear. So you told me we'd win this, now we got this terrible result, and
Right.
I think one thing with litigation as well, this doesn't have so much to do with collection of fees, but about client communications, is that in my experience as a business litigator and a divorce litigator, it's rare that a client comes out of the end of a trial with a judgment with which makes them feel completely vindicated. There's so much compromise that goes into these decisions it really is good from the beginning to have a client thinking about the value of resolution and of settling preparing them for that. At some point perhaps having to hold their nose and agree to something that isn't really what they want, an understanding that they're unlikely to get everything they're looking for, no matter how much they believe in their case. And I have found that, too. When I talk to a client about the virtues of the other side's case, I've had clients who act like I don't believe them or I'm not advocating for them, when I'm just trying to give them advice and help them to understand it. Somebody had a question?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
This may seem to be a rather simplistic question, but let me say that I was in court once in a family court setting, and there was what would be considered a high-powered divorce attorney,
trying a case which I thought was rather routine. And part of the testimony was, well, what have my fees been, ma'am? And she said $40,000. Well, I got a flavor for the case and basically how difficult the case was by sitting there listening to it. It's something that I would have probably charged $5,000 or $6,000 to do, soup to nuts. My question to you is, how do you know what you're worth?
The question, I have to repeat this for the audience who, we can see them, but they don't know that on the computer. How do you value what you're worth in terms of your fees? How do you make those estimates if you do?
Well, you mean some way other than an hourly rate? Or, I mean, I think...
Some divorce lawyers
yes.
will charge $200, $250, $300, $400 an hour.
Yes.
And I try cases against them all the time. And they're just, to me, you know, why wouldn't they be charging $125 or $150 or $75? What makes them so different?
I think people will charge if there's a demand for their services because they're good, they can charge a higher rate. It's just, I think it's market forces. I also tell people I always tell clients that I can do a better job of finding them a lawyer than they will do themselves. And I, you know, will find lawyers who don't, I have people that I refer cases to who do what I don't do, things that I don't do. And I usually tell them, often the lawyer with the higher hourly rate will do it more quickly because he or she will know the answers. They won't spend time learning the subject matter or researching something because they specialize in this area, they know it, they can deal with it more efficiently. So I suppose with a trial, it's hard to, you know, you're stuck there. I had a divorce trial that took 8 days over about 6 months, and that, you know, I had no control over how much time that was taking. There's so much wasted time built into that,
The fee rule, 1.5, has always had as its introduction the list of the factors that go into more or less setting your hourly rate. And I do think that one of them that is, you know, is the fee customarily charged in the locality, you know, so that there's all these other things that your experience and how long it's, you know, the time and labor required, how novel, difficult. But I think you also have to pay attention with what yeah. David is calling the market forces. You know, what are other people charging? If you're undercharging, maybe you should think about that, you know.
Did you have a question?
I did. It sort of goes into that. I was like, how do you determine the initial retainer? I mean, what factors would you use?
Because
I never seem to get that right.
Yes. The question is, how do you determine the initial retainer, or how do you decide an amount? That is difficult because if I'm taking on a divorce case and I ask for a $5,000 retainer, I know it's going to cost more than that. But I also don't want this. You know, you have some concern about losing the client as well, or them going to somebody else who isn't going to ask for that. I think it's, you know, there are some matters on which you can predict the approximate amount of time and work it's going to involve. And then there are litigation matters that are so dependent on what the other side does or what you know, happens during the case that it's really difficult to predict. But I do try to make clear to clients that I'm not telling them that the amount of retainer I'm asking for is their maximum exposure here, you know, that it's going to cost more than that if we go through.
David, does your fee agreement say that you're going to replenish the retainer when it goes low?
It does.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because I think that's the other critical thing here.
Yeah. And I've started being more specific about
it.
I used to have a general term that I'll ask you to replenish it. Now I say, if it dips below $1,000 at the end of a month, then you will replenish it.
Right. So that you're not billing in arrears once you've used up the initial retainer, that when you get down to $1,000, then you say, I need another $2,000 or I need another $5,000 or whatever it is you decide you need up front.
Without disclosing confidences, I'd be curious, what's your experience in when you think you ended up charging too low a retainer versus too much a retainer? What were the factors?
I think it might be an experience thing, like underestimating, so I do divorce and family work, and kind of underestimating the complexity of the divorce. What on the surface looks like a very simple, we should be able to come to some agreement, turns into this
Nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And that's part of that discussion, David, saying you have up front, and that's why you have to replenish the retainer, not just say, once it's exhausted, I'm relying on you to, you know, honor my bills, you know,
right.
And pay me in arrears.
And interestingly, I've had a very distinct discussion with my client about returning money, because it ended up being much simpler than I thought. They had a little bit of money left over, and they're like, oh, keep it. And it's like, well...
Thank you very much. Sent you an email. That was very nice. Thank you. I appreciate the bonus.
A pleasant if rare.
Yes. Yeah, that doesn't happen very often. But
yeah.
Very nice.
You know, it's just, there was no reason for me. I just
that's a good problem to have.
Yeah. And you look good when you give it back.
That's right.
Yeah, and I do assure clients with this has to do with retainers, and when there's money left at the end of it, that's their money that comes back to them.
We'll catch the time.
Is it a violation of the disciplinary rules? Or, I'm old, so I call them disciplinary rules. But to take into consideration, especially on the domestic relations front, the assets and income of the parties involved.
For what purpose? In determining the hourly rate?
Is it appropriate to, you know, you've got somebody here who's a bus driver, you want to charge her $150, but you've got somebody who's a physician and you want to charge them $300.
There's nothing wrong with it.
So the question was whether it's anything wrong or in violation of the rules to charge different rates to different clients. And no, the answer is there isn't. I certainly do. You know, I one of the things I like about being in solo practice is that I can choose to do that. If I like a case and I want to represent somebody, but they can't really afford my rate, I can offer them a reduced hourly rate and take the case. I haven't done it on the other end where I have a particular high.
I'm comfortable with that one.
Yeah.
I'm perfectly comfortable with reducing it for someone who can't afford it.
No,
I'm dubious about ratcheting it up for what looks like the cash cow.
It has to be reasonable.
What's reasonable?
Reasonable is what's charged in the community for that kind of work. So if your normal hourly rates on a sliding scale, let's say $200 an hour to $400 an hour, you can't pick the cash cow and charge $600.
No, clearly.
But that's really what that leads to.
Mm-hmm. But I think the other part of that is in terms of the retainer, if it's a high asset case and you have an understanding this is going to be complex, I would ask for a much bigger retainer from that person. You know, it's just that a lot of people, it's hard for them to come
over. Fighting over Chippendale instead of Bob's Warehouse.
Right.
Bob's Warehouse gets fought over a lot, let me tell you that.
Yes.
That's the answer.
Okay. All right.
That's the answer. Join a bar association. Question is, how do you determine what the hourly rate is in the community?
Yeah.
Ask friends. Ask others.
Yeah,
tell me what the range is you charge. Why do you do it?
That's more uncomfortable for me than talking to clients about, you know.
But also you have to look at, you know, are you the person who's 2 years out of law school? You shouldn't be charging the, you know, you're going to be learning on the job. And we do have... We do have an SJC decision where the court said in deciding that something was an excessive fee that you should not be paying more for the inexperienced lawyer who has to learn. This is what Jim and Dave have been saying, who has to learn everything that the experienced lawyer already knows. This had to do with an OUI case and an excessive fee in an OUI case, and it's like, you know, the general range on those, the highest anyone could come up with, and this was way out of the norm, was about $15,000. This guy wanted to charge $50,000, and the SJC said, no. Just because you had to learn this all from scratch, you know, doesn't entitle you to pay you for your education. Exactly.
I understand that, but I just, you know, it's always been kind of mysterious to me.
I think... Join a local bar, and then, you know,
and
that's
then,
where you find the people who'll bid.
Go on to MATA has a website with a listserv, and you can post it saying, I'm interested in anybody can tell me what the range of fees are the folks normally charge. Works very well.
And just don't necessarily, if you're not busy or something, it's not, if you lower your rate, you know, where you charge a you know, say you start charging $60 an hour or something, I doubt that gets you more clients. That's going to, clients who talk to other lawyers are going to think this person must not know what they're doing, or they must be desperate.
I've been practicing for a while, and I've always had the same rate, and I don't know if I should raise it because
probably
talk to your talk to your spousal unit or your accountant. Wow. Okay, have two conversations. Two votes.
Let me just say one thing that came up in response to what I was thinking of in response to this question over here, and then I'll cover this question. I, in my family law cases and in some other kinds of litigation where you have a chance of getting an award of fees, if I discuss that with the client, I make sure that I state in my fee agreement that there is no guarantee. We're not making any assumptions about collecting our fees or about, you know, I don't want a client, you know, at the end of the case to say, well, you said they'd order him to pay my fees. And so I think it's important to be, again, good communication, very clear about that as well. There was somebody back here.
I'm just thinking that if you established your rate, someone told me in terms of the time, a good rule of thumb is to double the amount of the retainer because it often takes twice as many hours as you expect. A lot of times I find I don't charge
questions.
Yes.
So he had said, figure out what you think is a fair retainer and double it. That way you'll have enough time, you know, and you can always refund if, you know, it settles more quickly.
So this question has to do with the amount of the retainer and the fact that you may get a retainer and then the time charges could be double what your retainer was. If you can get a retainer of twice that amount, so much the better for you. But you also, I think, you need to be clear with the client that you're not telling them that the amount they're paying as a retainer is the most that your fee is going to be, unless you're agreeing to that. You know, I think you're telling them this is an advance against fees, but it isn't, you know, the most you could have to pay. So that if you end up charging them twice what your retainer was, you haven't made any kind of representations to them that that was all it was going to be.
David, my apologies. There are two questions. There are live people on the web. I just got two questions.
All right.
One question is, what are the sources, if any, out there for the market rate in the industry, especially since lawyers tend to be protective of their billing practice? And I think that's the answer we just gave. I'm sorry if we beat you to it. But bar associations and talk to friends. And I think, frankly, lawyers are willing to talk about that. The second question is, if a Massachusetts and New Hampshire attorney is working for a Massachusetts law firm for a potential client in New Hampshire, do you have to have a written fee agreement since New Hampshire's rules are different? Well, I don't know what New Hampshire's rules are. The writer, who's a friend of mine, you'll know what the answer is, David. But I think if you're involved with a Massachusetts-based matter, it ought to be in writing.
There's no downside.
I think it's a good business
crazy
practice
not to.
Even if we didn't have that rule, I'd be saying that you're better off having a written agreement.
And plus, because I know how old the writer is, your memory's not as good as it used to be.
All right, so that's...
We used to work together.
C and A. The next one is S, system. Have a good system for recording your time. And record it, a system for recording your time as you go. Not getting to the end of the month and trying to think about how much time you spent on each of your cases. I've started using a little timer, and I think some of the billing software programs actually have a timer. I find I'm much more disciplined about this if I have a timer running. And if I get some interruption, a personal call, I respond to an email or something, I stop the timer. And then I switch it back on again. And then I have a really reliable record of how much I spent on the matter. It makes me a little more disciplined in making sure I'm completely focused on that matter while the timer's running. And it's going to be much easier to generate my bills.
Time slips will do that.
Yes. I used to use Time Matters, which did that. Yeah. I'm now using QuickBooks, which I think there's some add-on that would do that, but I just found a simple timer app which is doing it, which is fine for me. Write down what you did. Make a good record of it. Use verbs. Describe the tasks that you performed, because your bill is not only a basis for getting paid, but it's a report to the client on what you've been doing on their case. And it, the more detail you have, the easier it is to justify the fee that you are charging and the time that you're billing them. So make that, just have a system and stick to it for recording time, reporting it to the clients, and it's become so much easier to do that now than it used to be.
Okay, so now you have a divorce practice. You have to be careful about, and everybody
yes.
does. You go ahead.
Yes, okay. So we're getting into here is issues of attorney-client privilege. Do you, you know, how much do you reveal in your bills in a matter in which somebody may be reviewing your invoices? I think you just need to be mindful of that. I think you can still state you spent, you know, 20 minutes on the phone with the opposing lawyer or with your client or with, now if there's some expert witness and you're speaking with them and you haven't decided whether to retain them and maybe you don't mention the person's name, you can just mention expert witness. Your client will know who it was because you will have explained that to the client separately. But just, yeah, being in any case in which you either could be seeking, you could be seeking your fees or a court or opposing lawyer could be reviewing your bills, think about how much you want to disclose about that. But certainly subject matters, discuss with client, you know, preparation for trial or prepare to witness something, none of that is going to be harmful if somebody else sees it.
Courts are pretty protective of confidential information that is redacted from bills. Even if you've got a submission under a statutory fee possibility or in a divorce case you move to submit, we end up doing redacted bills on occasion and judges have been receptive to that. But you sure, unless you really want to nail somebody, you sure don't want to say my client admitted that they killed the person. You know, probably not a great idea.
So conversation with client in which
client. Right, in which client, yeah. Admission, yeah.
Good night and have a good day.
So this system that you have needs to include actually sending the bills out and sending them out early. I represented a woman who was being sued by her lawyer for legal for fees. And one of his bills was for something like $20,000 for a month's work. And he sent it to her about 6 months after the month in question. And I'd say that looks like a person who really doesn't care very much about getting paid. It's not helpful to report to the client 6 months later what you did in November of 2015. And if you really want to get paid, you want to get these bills out quickly. If there's any, if the client has a problem with your bill or is shocked by it or is disagreeing with some strategy, the earlier you have that conversation, the better. And, of course, the sooner the client gets the bills, the more likely you're to have those kinds of conversations.
Well, so if you send them out monthly, you've got a stopple working. The client doesn't
yes.
object, you can argue that they waived. So.
Yes, that's yeah. right, yes. So they didn't have a, you know, if they don't complain about your time charges
yep.
until 3 years later, you have a pretty good argument there that you were reasonable.
Yep.
Some do's and don'ts on this, on recording time and tracking your time. I think it's important to make sure the clients feel they were treated fairly in their billing. I sometimes write down the time charges. I often will, if I spend a short amount of time on something in the middle of doing something else, I'll write it on their bill, but there'll be no charge. I think you have to have a long-term view here, and a happy client is possibly a source of future business. You're always better off having people feel good about you and feel that you were ethical and honest and fair with them than have them have resentments after they receive your bills and you apply that retainer against a huge bill. Bill your clients for lawyer work. Don't bill them for work that would be done by an administrative assistant or a paralegal if you had one. That's one of the things I find myself doing. I do, as a solo, a lot of tasks that in another firm a non-lawyer would be doing. I might report that in my bill, but I'm not going to charge the clients for that work or not going to charge them my hourly rate. I try to pay attention to the quality of my time. You could be having a conversation with a client while you're driving home from work, and you're not at your desk, you're not taking notes. Maybe that isn't necessary. Maybe what you're conveying is something you're able to give them good advice and it's good quality time. But just think about that and think about it from the client's perspective as well. I had a woman who was helping me with my website who only ever seemed to call me when she was driving. And she never followed up on things. And I'm sure it's because she wasn't writing them down and I wasn't getting her full attention, and I myself felt a little resentful about that. So consider that. Maybe you have a conversation, return a call in the car, and you record it on your bill and you don't charge the client for it. So they see that you're not charging them for it. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody in this room or one of the people watching this online has responded to a text message or email during my presentation. Maybe it was from a client. All right, is that the same quality? Hopefully you were listening to us here. So is that client getting your hourly rate's worth of business when you respond to that email? I think just be careful about those things.
These two guys were listening.
Yes, if they're doing it online, it's easy for them to be responding to emails. Don't incur large client expenses without having prepared the client in advance. I write in my fee agreements that if I'm going to incur an expense of over $100, I'll get their prior approval whenever possible. When clients realize how much it costs for a deposition transcript, they might think twice about whether they really need the deposition of everyone, every possible witness. And this addresses the case that Connie mentioned earlier, the OUI case. Don't learn a new practice area on the client's dime. I have found in my business litigation practice is fairly varied, and I've had some matters on which I didn't have prior experience, land use or municipal litigation. If I spend several hours reading up on that, I don't think it's fair of me to bill the client for that time when if they went to a lawyer who specialized in that area, they would already know the answers and know the stuff that I just learned. And I try to reassure clients about that as well, because I want them to know, again, that I'm going to treat them fairly and I'm going to represent them well, but I'm not going to be charging them as for my learning curve. All right. Yes.
And this is something I struggle with. The minimum time, particularly for court appearances.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, great point. And actually, I had that in my notes, and I hadn't mentioned it. So you were asking about the time for court appearance when you're in court.
Or minimum time billings.
Yeah. Okay. Because you don't know when the case is going to be called. You'd be there for an hour.
Yes. So the question has to do with when you're in court, and this comes up a lot for probate and family court lawyers. I think probably more than superior court, and maybe district court lawyers as well, because every case is on for 9 a.m. and some of them aren't reached until the afternoon, and you're spending all these hours in court hanging around, some of it waiting for your case to be called. How do you bill the client for that? Do you limit the hours you bill the client for that? I think some of this comes down to client communication and what the client's expectations are. One of the things to inform clients about litigation is that there is that aspect to it. There's a lot of inefficiency there. And on the one hand, you might say they're taking you away from other work and they're taking up all of your time, and so they should pay for that. However, it's hard for a client to get a $1,500 or $2,000 bill for one day in court when you're before the judge for 10 minutes. I generally... I don't bill for the whole day if I'm there for the whole day. So if I'm on a 9 o'clock case and I get called at 4 p.m., the client may get billed for 4 or 5 hours. I will mark the bill down. I'll have the client see that on the bill that I didn't charge him for all that time. If you are billing the client for all of your time, I think you need to make sure you spend that time as much as possible working on the client's case. I see this in probate court all the time, where lawyers are off seeing their friends and chatting about something, and they leave their clients alone on the bench. And the clients see all this. They see how you're spending your time in court. And then imagine how they're going to feel when they get a bill for 6 or 7 hours of your time when you spent it, off on a separate bench reading Lawyers Weekly or the newspaper or chatting with your friends or the court staff. So, be mindful of how you're billing them for this and what their expectations make sure that you set their expectations. You can also work on other matters and tell the client, I may work on other matters while I'm there, but of course I won't bill you for that time that, you know, most of us have work that we can carry with us. Yes?
It's not so much what you do, what the rules of ethics require you
to. So
there's no bright.
I don't think there's
the question.
The question was, do the rules of ethics have any particular requirements for if you have, I assume you're asking about if you have a day in court and there's
what turns.
I think that you are. I don't know
yes,
of any.
You are.
I think it's a
you're
matter.
Spending it on the client's time. You are.
Yeah. I just think, again, thinking about having a happy client at the end of the process and a client who thinks he or she was treated fairly. If you can use that time for some other client's matter or not bill the client for all of that time, you're gonna have a better client relationship.
I think driving time is the same issue.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I mean, yeah, you can, you know, you can charge $300 an hour to drive from Boston to Plymouth. It's probably not good business.
The two separate questions in here is one, is there a prohibition against doing it? And the answer is no. And the second one is should you? And David and Connie have answered that better than I did.
Yes.
When you send your bill out, let's say the first of every month or the fifth of every month, and does it make sense to give some lead time to the client before you take the funds from your client's
bank account?
I'm here with the rule in front of me, and before David went on to
right,
age,
yes,
I
yes.
was about to jump in on this, which is that you can't. The other reason for not letting that $20,000 bill sit for 6 months is that you cannot pay yourself from your retainer, from the funds you are holding, until you have billed. It either has to be before or simultaneous with when you pay yourself. If you do it simultaneously and the client then starts screaming, you sat in court all day and we're working on your other client's case, why are you billing me? You have to put the disputed portion back into the trust account. So there's something to be said for sending the bill out 5 days before you pay.
And that's why my concern
right.
is that it would seem to me you don't want to raise the issue like that your bill is unfair. So that you don't want to say if you have a concern,
put it in your
feet. If you have a dispute or something, you know, please give me a call. But I think it's eminently reasonable to say, if you have any questions, please
right.
give me a call, wait 10 days, and then make the transfer.
5 days. It's not a bad idea to put this in the fee agreement that I'll send the bill out,
right.
and, you know, if I haven't heard from you in 5 days, I'll assume we're all on the same page.
It's actually a simple matter in this instance to back and fill. If the client raises an issue, you pull it back out of operating, put it into IOLTA until the issue is resolved
right.
of the disputed
you
portion.
Know,
it's very easy to do.
If for the 1 to 5, 10 days, you can, like, avoid the...
Yeah. You can do it simultaneously if you want, and you send out the bill for $3,000, pay yourself $3,000, and the client starts squawking about this day in court, and they're fighting, and they, you know, they say, you charged me $1,000, I don't think it should be more than $500. You put 500 back. 500 is the that's a bad example because the numbers are the same. You know, you say you charge 1,000. They say I don't think it should be more than 300. You put $700 back until you get it sorted out. Just don't have this be your last nickel because you will have to put the money back into trust.
And I do that. I don't wait 5 days. I send them the bill and I apply the retainer.
Yeah.
And most clients actually email their bills now, but I always have a line in there that says, if you have any comments or questions about any line items on the bill or anything else, just give me a call.
Yeah.
So I invite that without specifically saying, you know, if you're not happy with me applying your retainer against the bill. yeah. All right. So the H, we've done C-A-S-H, help. What happens when the client doesn't pay you? You've communicated well, you've got a fee agreement, you've got a retainer. Unfortunately, this is one of those cases where the fee was twice the retainer and you didn't get it replenished. Now you've done a great job recording, sending out your bills, and you're not getting paid. Why help? Well, because that's what you'll need if your client doesn't pay. You need, you know, I again, this is one of those things learned the hard way as a solo, to have good practices about actually getting paid. And one of the things, just as it can be uncomfortable talking with clients about money at the beginning, it can be uncomfortable talking with them about money when they owe you, but you have to get over that. And in my experience, the clients, when I call them, and you should call them, it's so easy. You can just get something off your desk quickly, but you have no guarantee that they're going to pay attention to it. They might read it and think, I'll deal with that later, and then not deal with it. There's nothing better than a phone call. And I think it's good for the lawyer who has the relationship with the client to be the one that makes the phone call. But often there's an explanation. You know, they're waiting for some money to come in. They'll pay you next week. It gives you something to follow up on. Clients, I think most of them understand that they're obligated to pay you, and they'll pay you. And I'm not sure if they're afraid of being sued by you or not. I haven't ever threatened a client with suit. But it is important to stay on top of that and to call them. And then if they make some sort of promise to you and then break it, call them again and stay in touch with them. That kind of contact is the best way. It's going to be the most, you're going to be most successful at getting paid. So what do you do if they still don't pay you? Well, the next, I suppose, would be a letter explaining, perhaps attaching their agreement and the invoices and telling them that they owe you. And then what? Well, do you sue them? Those of you who have your own firms know that when you complete a legal malpractice application, for legal malpractice insurance, there's a question on there: have you sued a client in the last 12 months? And there's a reason that question is on there. And the reason is that you are at a much higher risk of being sued for malpractice when you sue a client. As a litigator, I get that. I understand. If someone comes to me and they're being sued and they want me to represent them, I'm going to explore whether there is a counterclaim to be made against the other party. And that's the obvious counterclaim to be made, is you didn't do a good job on my case, or you overbilled me, or you made a mistake and we didn't get as much money as we should have gotten. So it's always better to try to talk the client into paying you, and often better to give up on collecting the fee and maybe perhaps kick yourself for not having gotten a bigger retainer, or address this when the client was only $1,000 behind instead of when they were $20,000 behind. But suing a client should be an absolute last resort. I do some criminal defense, an OUI case, flat fee, and the client paid half of it up front and was supposed to pay the rest just before trial and didn't, got a not guilty. I don't see any possibility of a counterclaim for malpractice there. I mean, we won. It's an absolute victory. He's off the hook. I still haven't. And part of it is, you know, is that how you want to be spending your time? It is a lot of stress and distraction associated with that as well. So think long and hard before filing suit. Some would advise that you perhaps get a consultation with a lawyer who represents people in malpractice cases and talk about the case so that you can anticipate whether you might be at risk of being sued. There's a case, Fishman, about a very interesting case about a lawyer who ended up suing a client and regretting it. I don't know if it's
Fishman versus
the materials
Brooks.
At all, the yeah. citation?
Okay. Fishman versus Brooks.
Fishman versus Brooks. It's a very interesting but scary case to read and ought to make any. That guy did a pretty bad job for his client, but it ought to make anybody concerned about being sued. Even if the suit is not meritorious, it's going to cost you. It's going to cost you in your malpractice insurance premiums. So not worth it.
It was the first case in Massachusetts that allowed the introduction of evidence of the violation of a disciplinary rule as evidence of malpractice. So it's also famous for that as well.
And, it's a good read. So,
and he didn't get the fee. And he got, a couple $100,000?
Yeah, he got whacked. And the insurance company testified against him. It was great stuff.
So cash, that's what it's all about. Just make sure you have excellent communication. Get in advance. Have a great system for recording and reporting on your work. And have that be in need of help as little as possible, because you do the first three really well. Two or three other just very general cautions. Don't undersell yourself. Don't be desperate about taking on a client. There are other clients out there, and if you sense there's a red flag there, there probably is, and sometimes you just need to go with your gut with certain matters. And don't agree to take a matter on principle. It's the client's principle. It's usually not yours. And, you can choose what you want to work for free on, and don't have the client persuade you that their case is the one you should take for free. And don't be too quick to throw out answers to legal questions, that initial phone call, and start giving advice over the phone before you've established an attorney-client relationship or any kind of fee arrangement. It is so tempting to do. I love doing that, is listening to a client's problem and helping them understand the different possibilities and explaining to them. But you can charge for that. And there's one word I use in those phone calls is consultation. Come in for a consultation. Well, let's schedule a phone consultation. I think implicit in that right from the beginning is that they're going to have to pay for this. And if it wasn't clear to them, you need to state, this is what I'll charge you for that, and you can send me the money, and then we can talk.
You know, as David said, he did a conflicts check before having that consultation.
Yes. All right. Thank you. That's
thank you
all
much.
I have. All right.